Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Luke 15, verses 1 and 2. It's a real honor to be asked to be part of the Read Together project. It was also a little daunting. My name is Ed Sims. I'm senior pastor at Huffman United Methodist Church. If you've ever looked into the Enneagram, then it may make sense to you when I say that I'm a 9. Some people might even say that I'm a little OCD. And that explains why I find great comfort in preaching the lectionary each week. It gives me the structure I need to find focus. So when I saw the list of possible scriptures to talk about this week, I confess that my anxiety spiked. It's the feeling I get when I go down the toothpaste aisle at the grocery store, especially if they've changed the packaging of what I'm used to buying, and I'm confronted with so many choices. How do I choose the right one? I read through the week's scriptures. How do I choose the right one? The Old Testament readings are mostly about the story of Joseph and his brothers, and it's a great story of brokenness and reconciliation and God working through really adverse circumstances to bring about good for God's people. That would be a good choice. Then there's the Psalms. Psalms always seem to speak to me deeply. This week's Psalms deal a lot with spiritual struggles and finding the presence of God in the things that we go through, and that would be a good choice. And then there's Luke's gospel. I just spent last fall preaching through many of the stories that are included in this week's reading. There are a lot of good stories there. I felt like my heart was telling me to talk about one of Luke's stories, but which one? After all, this section of Luke's gospel covers a lot of ground, literally and geographically. Jesus is gradually making his way to Jerusalem, and by chapter 19, he'll get there. But he seems to be taking his time, stopping and teaching along the way. And like I say, there's a lot of good stories here. Lost sheep, lost coins, lost sons, lost jobs. The rich man and Lazarus, healing 10 people who have leprosy, a persistent widow, a Pharisee and a tax collector, blessing little children, a rich man, a camel and the eye of the needle, Zacchaeus in a sycamore tree, the Palm Sunday entry into Jerusalem, and questions about paying taxes and marriage in heaven, the widow's mite, and all kinds of apocalyptic predictions. How can you choose just one? Here I am, taking deep breaths on the toothpaste aisle. I think the best thing for me is to take the advice of the king in Alice's Adventures in Wonderland and begin at the beginning and then go on until you come to the end. No, I'm not going to cover all the chapters 15 through 21. We'd be here all day. But it does mean that I'm going to begin with the week's first gospel reading, chapter 15. In other words, today I'm going to talk about finding lost stuff and end up by considering what it all tells us about what is important to God and what should be important to us. Chapter 15 begins with a really curious observation. It says, "All the tax collectors and sinners were gathering around Jesus to listen to him." Here's why that's curious. Back in chapter 14, Jesus had been saying some harshly demanding things, like, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even their own life, such a person cannot be my disciple." And, "Whoever does not carry their cross and follow me cannot be my disciple." And this one's a real stunner. "Those of you who do not give up everything you have cannot be my disciples." Jesus is setting the bar very high in terms of high commitment discipleship. And that is attracting tax collectors and sinners? Why would tax collectors and sinners be attracted to Jesus? Tax collectors worked for the Roman government. They were sellouts. They were cheats. Nobody liked them. Nobody trusted them. That's why they're lumped together with sinners. Sinners should know better. Sinners may know the commandments, but they don't live by them. Sinners may know the Jewish law, but they don't keep it. Sinners may know how upstanding, righteous people should act, but they either won't or can't act that way. Why would they be attracted to Jesus? Because Jesus welcomed them. because Jesus shared meals with them, because Jesus did not act holier than thou, did not judge them, did not condemn them for who they were and what they did. He just welcomed them. It was as if, instead of complaining about the changing neighborhoods around so many of our churches, we just went out and made friends. It was as if, instead of posting rants on Facebook about people who are politically or religiously different from, i.e. inferior to, us, we just invited them out for coffee and donuts. It was as if we invited someone who looks and dresses very outside our comfort zone to just go out to lunch with us. I wonder what would happen if, instead of wondering why more people don't come and participate in our church programs and activities, we just started doing nice stuff for the people in our neighborhoods, the businesses and homes around our churches. What would people say? Jesus welcomed tax collectors and sinners, and it drove the Pharisees and the scribes nuts. They grumbled and muttered and said, "This man welcomes sinners, and he even eats with them." Understand that sharing a meal together in the Middle East is not a casual event. Paul McCracken from the Jerusalem Institute for Biblical Exploration says that in Jesus' time, eating with another person created a bond of friendship that is deep, unbreakable, and unending. It's a pledge that the two people will never lie to one another, and that they will be available to give each other aid in all circumstances. That's how Jesus feels about sinners. By the way, that's how Jesus feels about you. That's how Jesus feels about you when, for example, he invites you to the communion table. Jesus ate with sinners, and it drove the religious types nuts. And so it's in that context in which Jesus told three parables about finding lost stuff. The first parable had to do with shepherds. People understood shepherds. Shepherds were an important part of the economy, but they were not important as people. By that I mean they did not rank high in status. It was a job for solitary males without children. In fact, a lot of times shepherds themselves were children. After all, children are too young to know any better. Once they've grown and gotten a little bit more worldly, they would understand that being a shepherd is not a great career trajectory. In fact, by and large, the occupation was despised. What do you want to be when you grow up? Nobody would willingly say, "I want to be a shepherd." Shepherds were generally considered unclean, unlearned, and undesirable. And that's really curious, that it was such a despicable job, considering the stories that are familiar to us in the Old Testament. Because King David was a shepherd. Moses was a shepherd. Father Abraham was a shepherd. Nevertheless, by Jesus' time, an adult shepherd was someone who is considered so inept or untrustworthy that there was literally nothing else they could do to earn a living. So it's interesting that Jesus would turn to the scribes and the Pharisees and tell this story by beginning, "What if you were a shepherd?" You can almost see them wrinkling their noses and smirking. For years, when I heard this parable about leaving behind the 99 sheep in order to go and find the lost one, I thought, that's pretty risky and maybe not too smart. What if something happened to the 99 while you were out looking for the one lost sheep? Is Jesus calling us to be irresponsible with what we have in order to go out and find what is lost? To find a lost sheep? What I didn't understand was the part about shepherding possibly being a children's occupation, because the children who worked as shepherds often worked in groups. There'd be about one child for every 20 to 25 sheep. Jesus' original listeners would have understood that the 100 sheep probably belonged to four or five brothers who had sent their youngest sons out to watch them. The young cousins would have helped each other and watched over the sheep of the one boy who went looking for the lost sheep. The important thing is, you don't want to lose even one. If someone is lost, you go after them. Even shepherds know that. On top of that, think about the way that children most children at least, love animals. They give them pet names. They pet them and love on them like we do our pets. So it's not just a sheep that is lost. It's Fluffy or Sassy or Speckles or Woolly Bear. Have you ever had a pet that got lost? I remember years ago, I had a cat named Misha. She used to stay outside while I was at work. This was when I lived in New Orleans, before I was a preacher. One day, a thunderstorm blew up in the afternoon, and when I came home, Misha was gone. And I was freaking out. I walked that whole neighborhood caring for her. I looked everywhere. When I couldn't find her, I was crushed. I was so sure that she had gotten run over or drowned in one of the nearby canals. It broke my heart. It was more than 2 weeks later that my phone rang and someone had found Misha. She had come up to their house begging for food. They lived almost 2 miles from where I did. I was so happy. The end of that story is that Misha became an indoor cat. I believe the shepherds, at least the good ones, probably loved their sheep that way. They knew each one and loved each one. They didn't want to lose even one. Sometimes a sheep did go missing. I'm quoting from Paul McCracken again here. He said, "It's quite easy to find a lost sheep. Sheep are very social animals and will not knowingly leave the flock. If one realizes that it has wandered away from the others, it will panic. Its muscles will lock rigidly into place and it will begin to bleat loudly and pitiably." By the way, one time when I preached this story at my church, I put a picture of a lost sheep up on the screen, and it so distressed people that a staff member asked me, "Please don't put that picture up again." Since the sheep cannot move, and it's bleeding loudly, the shepherd can find it quickly and easily. Unfortunately, a wolf or another predator can also find it just as quickly and easily. So the shepherd's search must be urgent if the lost sheep is going to be saved. When the sheep is found, it is somewhat comforted by the shepherd's presence, and it usually will stop bleeding. However, without the presence of the other sheep, its muscles will remain rigid. It will not follow the shepherd, and it must be carried. Depending on its size, a sheep can be extremely heavy, while the shepherd might be a small boy. Yet the shepherd rejoices as he hefts the sheep up on his shoulders and returns it to the rest of the flock. "It once was lost, but now is found." When the shepherd comes home, he calls together his friends and neighbors, saying to them, "Celebrate with me, because I found my lost sheep. I found Fluffy. I found Woolly Bear. I found Misha." Jesus says, that's what heaven is like. That's what God is like. Now, one sheep might not seem all that valuable to you, you know, since it's only 1% of the flock. So Jesus told another parable. He said, "A woman had 10 silver coins." The Pharisees rolled their eyes, "Shepherds and now women." Remember that most people in Jesus' time were extremely poor. 10 silver coins would have been the woman's entire life savings. It might very well have been her entire dowry. The dowry was money that was given to a bride at the time of her marriage, and it belonged to her. In a world that was dominated and controlled by men, the dowry belonged to her. It was in her control. It was her safety net, just in case anything were to happen to her husband. It could mean the difference between being able to survive as a widow and being cast out onto the streets. It could mean the difference between home and homelessness. One of those coins would have been 10% of her life savings. Remember when the stock market crashed a few years back? Remember what happened to some of our retirement accounts? I remember talking with a preacher friend of mine who was ready to retire when it happened, and he was so downcast. He said, "We thought we would be able to retire and live comfortably. Now it looks like I'll have to find a job just in order to pay for insurance and our medical bills." So when one of the woman's coins turns up missing, it is no small matter. Her search is not casual. She sweeps the dirt floor, she lights an oil lamp in the dimly lit house, and she gets down on her knees to look for what is precious and valuable. God, show me what has been lost. Lead me to what has been lost. Maybe the reason we don't get down on our knees to seek those who are lost is because we just don't think they are that precious. But they are in God's sight. At last, the woman's searching pays off. She can just see the glint of the coin down in the crack between two stones on the floor. When she's found what was lost, she calls together her friends and neighbors, saying, "Rejoice with me, I have found my lost coin. It once was lost, but now is found." Jesus says, that's what heaven is like. That's what God is like. The last of the three stories is probably the most familiar to us. In fact, my guess is that a lot of folks know this story, even when they don't know the meaning of the word prodigal. The story of the two sons and the forgiving father is so familiar that chances are we've come to take it for granted. I grew up hearing about these two sons. But when I read all three stories as a group, a new question came into my mind. Jesus has already made his point pretty well with the story of the lost sheep and the lost coin. Why this third story? I understand that often in the Bible, three signifies completion or wholeness, but what is there that needs to be completed? What is there that needs to be made whole in order for us to understand what Jesus wants us to hear? I wonder if it has to do with what is actually being lost. In the first story, it's a sheep. In the words of one of my favorite Monty Python quotes, the trouble is, sheep are very dim. Dumb animals, but innocent. They don't know the difference between right and wrong. When they get lost, it's not because they have gone off in search of greener pastures. They simply look around and discover, "Holy cow, I'm lost!" In the second story, it's a coin that gets lost. And a coin is an inanimate object, no question of guilt or innocence. A coin is not going to know right from wrong. But the third story is about a lost son. A son who essentially goes to his father and says, "I wish you were dead right now so I could get my inheritance." He's breaking one of the Ten Commandments, isn't he? Despicable, bad to the bone, selfish sin personified. But the father loves him. So the father does what the son asks. I don't mean that he dies, but he does go ahead and give the son his inheritance. You know how the story goes. The son takes the money, and what does he do? He wastes it all on loose living. And finally, he comes to his senses and goes back to his father, begs forgiveness, and because the father still loves him dearly, receives that forgiveness, is restored to the family, and receives treatment that he really doesn't deserve. He once was lost, but now is found. And it drives his loyal, obedient brother nuts. But the son is found, and there's a celebration. And Jesus says, that is what heaven is like. That is what God is like. So here's one last question. What's the difference between a sheep, a coin, and this despicable, bad to the bone, selfishly sinful son? The son should have known better. He knew right from wrong, and he still sinned. He was, in a word, a sinner. And yet, the loving father welcomed the son home, even though the son had lived a thoroughly sinful and self-centered life. And Jesus says, that is what heaven is like. That's what God is like. Jesus says, if you want to be my follower, maybe you need to open your ears to hear the cries of the lost lambs. Those cries are all around us if you only have ears to hear. Jesus says, if you really want to be my follower, maybe you need to get down on your knees and look for what is valuable, to search for what is truly precious. Jesus says, if you really want to be my follower, maybe you need to see people the way that I see them. Sinners, and yet beloved children. Children who long to come home. Instead of expecting them to straighten out their lives first and then come and ask to spend time with us in church, maybe we need to find someone whose life is a mess and just offer to be their friend. Not to fix them or to change them. That's God's job. Just be a friend. In doing so, you just might help them find their way home. And that, well, that would be enough. Amen. Loving God, help us to be a friend. Help the lost to be found. And help us all to find our way home. In Jesus' name, amen.